8. Oh, moment, stay. Whose bald head is that, rubbing the back of mine?
I'm in a poetic mood, my child. Let's have a chat.
Actually, I'm busy.
Come off it. Busy? I'm upset, Glebotchka. Sitting by that improvised German Christmas tree, I started talking about my dugout in the bridgehead north of Poutusk, and suddenly it all came rushing back. The war, life at the front. So vivid, so nostalgic. Listen, war has its good points, wouldn't you say?
You aren't the first I've heard say so. I've read in those magazines for German soldiers that sometimes came our way. The Cleansing of the Soul, Soldatenteuer.
Swine. But if you like it, there's a rational kernel in all that. I refuse to believe it.
The Taoist ethic says that weapons are the instrument of misfortune, not honour. The wise man wins reluctantly.
What's this I hear? The ex-skeptic has signed up with the Taoists now?
I haven't quite decided.
I started by remembering my favourite Fritzes, how we used to make up captions for leaflets. The mother embracing her children, her flaxen-haired Margarita weeping, that was our main leaflet, with the message in verse.
I remember it. I used to come across them.
And suddenly, it all came back in a rush. Did I ever tell you about Milka? She graduated from the Institute of Foreign Languages in 1941, and they posted her to our unit as a translator. A snub-nosed girl, moved a bit awkwardly.
Hold on. Was she the one who went with you to receive the surrender of Grugions?
Aha! Extraordinarily vain little thing she was. Loved being complimented on her work, and woe betide anyone who told her off. Loved being recommended for decorations. Remember the woods just beyond Lovat, to the south of Podziepice, as you go from Rachlitsi toward Nova Svinuchova?
It's all woods around there. This side of the Redia or the other?
This side.
Right, got it.
Well, she and I went rambling in those woods. We were there all day. It wasn't spring yet. March. You squished about in water, sloshed through the puddles in your felt boots. Your head was drenched with sweat under your fur cap, but there was that wonderful smell. You know, that air. We wandered about like young lovers, like newlyweds. Well, if a woman's new to you, you relive it all together from the very beginning. You blossom and ripen like a young lad and, you know, that never-ending forest. Just occasionally smoke from a dugout, a battery of 76s in a clearing. We avoided them. We went on wandering till evening, a damp pink sunset. I'd been aching for her all day. And suddenly a crate started circling overhead, and Milka decided she didn't want to see it shot down. It's doing no harm, and if it isn't shot down, fine. We'll spend the night out here in the forest.
That meant she'd surrendered. Whoever saw our anti-aircraft gunners hit a crate?
Right. Every AK-AK gun on either side of the Lovat blazed away at it for a good hour and never touched it. So we found an empty bunker.
A surface bunker?
Yes. Remember them? They'd built a lot of them the year before, like dens for wild animals.
The ground was too wet to dig in.
Right. The floor inside was strewn with pine branches. There was a smell of resin from the walls and of smoke from previous fires. There were no stoves. You had to make your fire right there on the floor. There was a little hole in the roof. No light, of course. As long as the fire was burning, it cast shadows on the timbered walls. That's living, eh, Gleb?
I've noticed that if one of the characters in a story told by a prisoner is a maiden, all the listeners, including me, are desperately anxious for her to be a maiden no longer when the story ends. In fact, that constitutes the main interest of the story for the Zek. This shows a need to know that there is justice in the world, don't you think? A blind man needs to be reassured by the sighted that the sky is still blue and the grass still green. The Zek needs to believe that, theoretically, there are still real, live, attractive women in this world, and that they give themselves to lucky men. Some evening, you've remembered. Making love and in a pine-scented shelter at that, with no shooting going on. Some kind of war, that is. Only that same evening your wife was changing her sugar coupons for a sticky mess of sweets squashed into the paper, and planning to ration them so that they'd last your daughters 30 days.
Go on, then, reproach me. A man mustn't know just one woman, Glebka. If he does, he knows nothing at all about them. It impoverishes the human spirit.
The spirit, as well. Didn't somebody say, if you've really known one woman,
that's rubbish.
What about two, then?
Two will get you nowhere either. Only by comparing many can you begin to understand. It's no vice, no sin. It's nature's design.
Coming back to the war. In cell number 73 in Butyrki, along a narrow corridor on the second floor.
Just so.
A young Moscow historian, Professor Razvodovsky, who had just been put inside and had never, of course, been at the front, argued cleverly, passionately, and cogently, on social, historical, and ethical grounds, that war has its good side. There were 10 frontline soldiers in the cell, some ours, some Vlasovites, but all desperate characters, wildcats. They'd fought in every spot you can think of, and they almost tore that professor apart. They furiously denied that there was the least little smidgen of good in war. I listened and said nothing. Razvodovsky's arguments were strong ones. At moments I thought he was right, and my own recollections sometimes suggested that there was good there, but I didn't dare argue with those soldiers. The something on which I was ready to agree with a civilian professor was the same something which made me, a heavy artillery man, different from the infantry.
Just think, Lev, except for the time when you took that fortress, you were just a desk soldier at the front, never in a close engagement from which retreat would have been more than your life was worth. I wasn't much more of a soldier myself. I was never in the first wave of an offensive, and I never had to rally the men. You know how it is.
Memory is treacherous, and all the honours sink to the bottom.
Look, I'm not saying,
and only the pleasant things remain. But ever since Junker dive bombers nearly made mincemeat of me one fine day at Aryol, sorry, I just can't recapture the pleasure. No, Lyovka, war is best when it's farthest away.
Well, I'm not saying that war itself is good, only that we can have good memories of it.
So maybe we'll have good memories of the camps one of these days, and of the transit prisons.
Transit prisons? Gorky? Kirov?
No. Just because the administration there swiped your suitcase, you refuse to look at it objectively. Ask a VIP, with a job in the clothes storeroom, say, or the bathhouse, and shacked up with a love girl. He'll tell you there's no place like a transit prison. What it comes down to is that happiness is a relative concept. It's all in the mind.
Etymologically, the Russian word for happiness has unmistakable connotations of transience and insubstantiality. Shastye comes from sichasye, meaning this hour, this moment.
Sorry, my learned friend, it doesn't. Look it up in Dal. It comes from surchastye, the share a person rests from life. Its particular etymology gives us a pretty sordid conception of happiness.
Just a minute. My explanation also comes from Dal.
You surprise me. So does mine, I tell you.
This calls for research in all languages. I'll make a note.
Madman.
It's an idiot who says so. Let's do a bit of comparative philology.
Like Ma, you mean? Everything derives from the word for hand.
You bum, you. Listen, have you ever read Goethe's Faust, Part 2?
Why don't you ask whether I've read Part 1? Everybody says it's a work of genius, but nobody reads it. Some people rely on Gounod's version.
No, Part 1 is quite straightforward. What's the problem? Of suns and worlds I cannot speak. Human toil is all I see.
Now, that does something for me.
Or there's this. What we don't know is just what we needed. What we know is no use to us.
That's great.
Part 2, I admit, is heavy going. But what a profound idea. You know the contract between Faust and Mephistopheles. Mephistopheles will take possession of Faust's soul only when Faust cries, "Stay, fleeting moment, thou art beautiful."
But whatever Mephistopheles lays before him, the return of his youth, Margarita's love, easy victory over his rival, boundless wealth, knowledge of all the secrets of existence, nothing can wring from Faust's breast the fateful exclamation. Many years have passed. By now Mephistopheles himself is worn out, trailing after this insatiable being. He sees that there is no way of making the man happy, and is ready to abandon this barren sport. Faust, by now aged and blind all over again, gives orders for thousands of workers to be summoned to dig canals and drain the marshes. His brain, senile for the second time, and, or so the cynic Mephistopheles thinks, crazed and clouded, is aglow with a grand idea: to make mankind happy. At a signal from Mephistopheles, hell's servants appear and start digging Faust's grave. Mephistopheles has lost all hope of winning his soul and simply wants to bury him, to be rid of him. Faust hears the sound of many shovels. "What is that?" he asks. The spirit of mockery has not deserted Mephistopheles. He paints Faust a false picture of the draining of the marshes. Soviet critics like to interpret this passage in the spirit of socialist optimism. As they would have it, Faust, feeling that he has benefited mankind and finding in this his supreme joy, exclaims, "Stay, fleeting moment, thou art beautiful." But we have to ask ourselves whether Goethe was not ridiculing the idea of human happiness. Because in reality nothing whatsoever has been done for mankind. Faust pronounces the long-awaited sacramental phrase, "one step from the grave," deluded and perhaps truly insane, and the lemurs immediately hustle him into the hole. Is this Goethe's hymn to happiness, or is he ridiculing it? Ah, this is the Lyovochka I love, reasoning from the heart, talking wisely, and not sticking abusive labels on things. You miserable latter-day pyro, I knew I would make you happy, and I haven't finished yet. In one of my pre-war lectures, they were devilishly daring, I developed this excerpt from Goethe into the elegiac idea that there is no such thing as happiness, that it is either unattainable or illusory. Then, suddenly, a note was passed to me, a page torn out of a miniature notebook, squared paper. But I am in love, and I am happy. What do you say to that? What did you say? What can anybody say?